You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today. Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
One of my favorite people to talk about writing with is Tucker Max. I just read this. I didn't know this before, but there's only three people in history that have had three books at the same time on the New York Times bestseller list. One of them is Tucker Max, my guest on the podcast today, and the other two are Michael Lewis and Malcolm Gladwell. Since I didn't know that before this podcast. But anyway, I always love talking with Tucker about what is the nature of a story, how important story is to success, whether it's in writing or business or in relationships. And once we establish that, we get right into how do you tell a good story, no matter what your objectives are. So here we go, part two of the Tucker Max episodes. So you've been posting every day or every couple of days this lessons you've learned, and it's very nice. They're not like blog posts. So I really appreciate this new style from you. It's just like these very short, concise, but very poignant lessons you've learned. And you have one which basically says, in sort of a battle of ideas and stories about ideas, the person who can tell the right story is going to be the better idea even.
Oh, yes.
And I think that's a meta skill, and you've been referring to it in this podcast. That's almost a meta skill. No matter what you do, no matter what your skills are, you need to be able to tell the story about those specific skills. And I agree with that completely.
I mean, that's the next product we're building at Scribe. Is the storytelling course and the storytelling, like tell your story. We're going to build like as a memoir, tell your story, but then also storytelling as a skill. There are a lot of good people who know how to teach that. We're going to teach it, I think, a little bit of a different angle on that. Tie back to young people. In the coming economy, there's two skills, programming
right. And
storytelling. And storytelling encompasses sales, marketing, all that. If you can do one really well, you're going to be great. If you can do both, then you could be like figuratively a god. And I can only think of a few people who can do both. Mark Andreessen can do both.
Yeah. It's interesting because look at great companies like Apple. Think about it. Steve Wozniak had the programming. Steve Jobs had the storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
I would argue Google, both Larry Page and Sergey Brin could do some. They were both pretty good at both. You don't think?
No. Think about this. Think about the head start Google had in every field, and it basically screwed all of them up. The only reason Google still exists is because it owns search, and search is so dominant. But like, look at all the companies. There's dozens, hundreds of billion-dollar companies that carved off stuff that Google could have. Google does not tell a great story. Google just got there early, right? Google is very vulnerable. Facebook is very vulnerable. Twitter is extremely vulnerable. I can see Parler's gonna carve off a huge chunk.
I think Parler has something like 2 million users right now.
Right, exactly. They're all very, very vulnerable. They have a lot of money and they have power. Amazon is the least vulnerable because Amazon tells a great story and has just told the same story over and over. And it's like, I order something, it shows up in my house every single time, and it's super cheap and it's high quality. Can't beat that. The other three, they're in trouble.
Yeah, I mean, and all the companies that tell stories are vulnerable. The Netflixes of the and all their competitors, the Netflixes, Disneys, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're going to run out of stories to tell.
No, you never run out of stories to tell. I don't think so.
They're going to run out of their stories.
Yes.
You know, ultimately, the public decides what stories Netflix can tell. It's hard for them to come up with a unique story. And
well, a lot of those companies are being captured by wokeism, and they're starting to see the impacts though. So we're going to start to, we may see the antibodies to wokeism develop in the corporate world.
I love the analogy. I love this antibodies to this.
You saw what happened with Nike, man. Nike lost in the middle of the explosive online growth moment. Nike lost $700 million. I think they're maybe they will, maybe they won't reconsider. They went full woke. They went full woke, right? And again, I want to be real clear. Supporting oppressed Black people in America, I'm all for. I'm all in. Supporting woke is a different thing, right? And they went full woke. They weren't like hey, we need to police reform. We need to They didn't do that. They're like, let's fucking kneel down. Give the middle finger to mom and dad. Like all that sort of shit, they suffered. Whereas like the companies that didn't, Under Armour did amazing. Their stocks through the roof. You're starting to see like the ones that it depends where and how they embrace wokeism. But I'm telling you, man, I'll tell you, this is another reason why who wins in November makes a big difference. If Trump wins, I think Trump and the conservative core go after and break up Facebook and Google, especially Google.
I wonder how you would do that. Like, what would you do? Because search.
Oh, are you kidding? You can wield antitrust law any way you want. Like, that's antitrust law is essentially voodoo. It's made up. Like, I'm telling you, as someone who studied this in law school, the iconic example is if you sell more than your competitor, it's price gouging. If you sell at your competitor's price, it's collusion. If you sell less, then it's flooding the market. Right. So you can make any. It is a power play. It is a pure and simple power play. And I can absolutely unequivocally, I think Trump will go after, well, really, I would say probably Twitter and Facebook even more than Google, although Google's trying to deplatform too. They're going to go after them. Absolutely unequivocally. That's one of the that's one of the big things, man. If the Democrats win, the tech state and the government state then merge. And then that's when you got to really worry about, it's not cancel culture anymore. Now it's like people disappear. Right. And like
that is my fear.
Like, oh, the end state of that is people disappearing. We're not gonna have people in December of this year, no one's disappearing. But the end state of technology and government merged is Soviet Russia.
Right. Well, and it's not,
that's what it is.
It's not like disappearing in the Soviet sense. It's not like disappearing in the Argentinian sense where, you know,
you literally disappear. Right.
Right.
It's disappearing in the Alex Jones sense. Yes.
Well, and it's also, it's like the technology allows people to pretend to have good intentions. Hey, we need to isolate you for XYZ reasons.
Yes.
Now there's a virus reason, but there's going to be other reasons. You know, there's going to be nonstop reasons, just like the way someone could defend freedom of speech, but at the same time say, but, you know, a U.S. senator shouldn't be doing an op-ed in the New York Times. Right. Like, you know, there's going to be all these people with good intentions. Like, well, yeah, we need to use this technology.
Think about the arrogance of the idea that a sitting U.S. senator needs to be deplatformed.
Right, and this is not even saying Republican or Democrat. Like,
a sitting U.S. senator.
Someone who was elected by millions of
should
people.
Should be deplatformed. Think about that for a second, and then you understand what the New York Times is. They are a partisan in an ideological war. That is what they are.
Everything is like that. Look at Twitch right now. And again, this is not about Trump, no Trump, whatever. But Twitch saying any politician is not allowed on Twitch anymore. And at the same time, last night, my daughter was shooting up prostitutes in Grand Theft Auto on Twitch.
So hold on. A platform says no politicians. I get it. Okay, fine. We're making a business decision to eliminate that sort of thing. I'm with it. That's not what...
Yeah, if you do it universally across the board, you can't just isolate,
I get it. Right. But Twitter's decided that Donald Trump tweeting about protecting the sovereignty of America is inciting violence. Dude, think about that sentence for a second. Do you understand? Like that, when I tell you, you have to pick a side, that is what I mean. It's here. It's in front of you. It's right fucking here.
But look, you know what's so funny, Tucker? Because this brings me back to 2013. You know, you were helping me with my book, Choose Yourself, and just that book there. The then CEO of Twitter wrote the foreword because Twitter then was this very choose-yourself medium. Like anybody in the world could have a voice.
It's very different then. Yes.
And now it's the... Right now, if I want to watch snuff videos... Like videos of people being killed, I can go on Twitter and watch 100 different videos, a million different videos of people being killed. Which, by the way, when we were kids, that you never would have been able to watch a video of that.
No.
But meanwhile, if I just tweet the word hydroxychloroquine or coronavirus, that tweet will probably be like shadow banned or banned or whatever.
Yes.
Just by the bots.
Yep.
But snuff videos, no problem. I just watched today by accident, and I really do mean by accident. Like I didn't realize it was going to happen. It's watch this guy getting shot right in the face and dying right on this video. As kids, were you able to watch a snuff video?
I keep telling you, wokeism is a death cult.
Yeah.
It just is. This is not like, it's not like I came up with this idea. Like I'm smart. I'm not like, you can look at it and see it's a death cult. That is what they are.
So tell me about what the different angle on storytelling. So obviously, we both told lots of stories in our lives. I always think of it kind of classically in terms of the arc of the hero and in vulnerability and sort of this concept of vulnerability buys you freedom. So being able to say what you want, you know, and being able to handle the consequences, that's freedom. And that goes along, that leads into the arc of the hero. So what's the angle, the twist you have on storytelling? Which, by the way, you're very vulnerable. People don't, I just want to say out loud, people don't realize, like, because I've seen people try to imitate your style of writing.
They
don't
work, does it?
They don't get it.
No one's ever been able to do it, ever.
No, because they don't get, and this is very similar to when I see people try to imitate Hunter S. Thompson.
Yeah.
They don't get that you're actually criticizing yourself in the books. That's the key, is that you're actually extremely vulnerable in these books. And when they try to imitate, they're just trying to glorify their adventures in college or whatever.
No, they're trying to get a narcissistic supply. They're trying to get the attention they see me getting. They are imitating what they see. They don't actually see what it is that gets me attention.
No, because it takes the skill of storytelling to understand the nuances.
I disagree. It takes a consciousness level. Hmm. They are not at that level of consciousness. They are not connected to anything or anyone around them. And that's why they can't see it. Even if, dude, I've had people try to imitate me who are excellent writers and excellent storytellers. You don't have to know how to tell a story to be vulnerable. They're different things, completely different things. Now, if you know how to tell a story and you combine it with vulnerability, you get magic, right? But you don't have to know how to tell a story to be vulnerable.
And you know, it's funny you say that because on the reverse side of things, I've seen people try to imitate me where they'll glorify their stories of failure. It's this whole category of what I now call failure porn.
Yeah, failure porn, exactly. Dude, there's a whole segment of marketers that do this now. It's obnoxious.
Right, but they can't tell a story. You're right. They are two different skills. And so it makes it very unappealing.
You can tell they're faking it because it's like the way they write about bankruptcy is like the way they perceive other people see bankruptcy. The way you wrote about bankruptcy was like, I've never been bankrupt, but I felt it. I felt it when you read it. I was like, oh God, I understand what this feels like.
Not pleasant.
I don't want to say you can't do that unless you've been through it, because that's not true. But it is extraordinarily difficult to write about things that you have not actually felt. And most people cannot do it. It takes a world-class novelist, screenwriter, storyteller to be able to tell a story with deep, vulnerable emotion about something they did not do. Like J.K. Rowling does it really well in Harry Potter. George R.R. Martin does it. No one's ridden a dragon or whatever. But they're still writing about very common human emotions. They're just projecting themselves in there. It's really hard to fake that.
Right. Like a great example of someone who can't do it actually is Charles Bukowski. So you look at his first four novels, Post Office, Factotum, Ham on Rye, Women, Hollywood. So for his first five novels, he's basically telling
his life,
a memoir and calling it a novel.
Yeah.
But then when he wrote his final book, Pulp, which was a pure detective novel, it was like one of the worst novels ever. Like he couldn't really write fiction.
Yeah, it's true. I tried to write fiction at the beginning and it was awful. It was the garbage. Oh, dude, it was the worst garbage dumpster fire of all time. And then I gave up and just told my stories and the rest is history.
Right. And I think that also began this wave of kind of literary nonfiction or narrative nonfiction, which I think has been a positive cultural, thing that's happened. Like I think those are the best stories right now. But tell me an angle on storytelling.
Well, the way that I think, I'm not sure, man, because we haven't really worked through it, but there's two things. Like the way we're going to teach memoir is very, very different. Like if you look at the way, and I have a whole shelf of all the big memoir books, they're all fucking garbage. They suck because none of them address the entire reason to write memoir, right? And I tell all the people in our workshop, if you want to join our workshop, it's free. You can watch the whole thing. Go to scribebookschool.com. It teaches all the instructions there.
So what's your scribe?
Scribebookschool.com. And then we have nonfiction and memoir. They're different tracks and you can do either one. But what we teach for memoir, it basically boils down to this. No one reads your book to learn about you. They read your book to learn about themselves. But the way they learn about themselves is through your honest and vulnerable expression of your emotions and your experiences.
And you wrote this in one of your lessons I've learned, and I thought this was very interesting. It made me, think of my own writing, but then it made me think of, you've probably read William S. Burroughs' Junkie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So again, he's another guy. I don't really like some of his later stuff, but Junkie is this very direct memoir-style book, which packaged as a novel, because that's what they were doing, about his experiences as a heroin addict in New York City. And it's very just, what was very interesting is he goes back and forth between the first person and the second person. And when he's doing the second person, you almost could imagine that he's writing a guide rather than a memoir. And I think it's that kind of hint of a memoir being a guide, which is basically what you're saying there, that people want to read about themselves. I think that contributed to his success in that, is that he says, you don't want to trust these kind of pimps because they do this. And so is he writing about himself experiencing these pimps, or is he giving it you suggestions because he's using the word you? And I think that is a very interesting way to look at it.
When you write second person, it just makes you feel like you're in a conversation, which works really well for memoir.
Yeah.
It depends when you're going back. You got to be a different kind of writer. Like I wouldn't recommend that for new writers.
Well, if you do it 100% of the time, then it feels a little like Jay McInerney, Bright Lights, Big City. It feels a little fake. You're right. It's too difficult. But if you go back and forth, I went up to the whorehouse. I brought all my, the $30 I had left. But, you can't mess around with pimps like this, blah, blah, blah. So if you go back and forth, and like you say, it's a combination of first person memoir, but then there's this slight hint of it being a guide as well as a memoir. And I think that's what you're alluding to. It makes it easier for the reader to acknowledge that I'm reading about myself rather than just reading about this guy being a junkie in the 1950s.
What memoir really boils down to for most people is the therapy they're afraid to do. Mm-hmm. And so we address that head on. If you're going to write memoir, you need to understand that this is a therapeutic process. and that if you try to avoid it, your memoir will be garbage and no one will read it, no one will care. But if you engage it and do as go as deep as you can and go as far as you can, you don't have to go all the way, just go as far as you can, then you, both you are going to get a lot out of it. And then we actually don't tell people they have to publish their book, because you will get an immense amount out of writing your book and putting it in a drawer. We generally recommend you probably should publish it for a lot of reasons. But then we have a guide we help people kind of figure out. But like, it's all of the stupid memoir guides, none of them really address the fact that, why do people want to write memoir? Why do they want to tell their story? Because they all approach it like, how do I sell this? Because they're author or professional writers trying to tell people how to be professional writers. Most people don't care about being professional writers. Like, if it sells, cool, like cash the checks, right? Most people want to tell their story, which is a totally different thing. And that is, at its core, both a therapeutic process and a heroic process. And so we help people understand that and unpack it and then walk through it and see their book as a journey where they are uncovering what their story is, who they really are, and being the hero that they needed, that they didn't have.
That's interesting. So I haven't thought of it as, I guess the closest I have come to thinking of it that way is when I advise people, don't publish something unless you're specifically afraid of what people are going to think of you. If at some point during the process you became afraid of what people are going to think of you if you say this publicly.
That's true for a memoir. That's very true for a memoir.
Yeah. And I wonder if it's true for other things as well. You know, for fiction.
It's true for nonfiction, just in that good nonfiction should put new ideas into the world, or new collections or new curations, or should challenge an established idea. Absolutely, we teach that as well. Like, I'm not going to write a book called The Sky is Blue. Why would someone be like, I know that. So it's got to be something new, some new idea or some new take. Whether that challenges you or not is a different idea. Like, I'm not going to be afraid of writing a new idea in memoir, because I'm not at that stage, right? So for nonfiction, is it additive to at least somebody's experience? Memoir, I'm with you about fear being a good guide, for at least for writing it. There's different things about publishing. You and I are different. Like, we're professionals, right? If someone's not a professional, there's a lot of other considerations that they have to go through before they publish, and they should go through. Not even just legal. Just take all that stuff out. A lot of people don't know how to just write about their experience. They know how to criticize others. They don't know how to talk about themselves. And so, like, that's something that we try to teach. But, like, unless they're getting editing from us, what we teach is, here was my experience. That's your memoir. Like, if the frame is, I'm telling you about what happened to me and what I felt and what I did, that's a memoir.
But I felt part is very interesting.
Oh, felt is layers, the key. Right. I felt is the absolute key. But if the frame is, here's my family's dirty, awful secret, even if you're talking about the same things, that's vengefulness, that's vindictiveness, that's you speaking from a wound instead of a scar, and it doesn't help you or anyone else.
Right. And by the way, there's a distinction between good writing and book sales. Because if you write, you know, there's a lot of books out there that are revenge books, and they do fine in sales. There's also a lot that do poorly in sales. So we're not really talking sales at all.
No. Because that's the only revenge books that do well, like celebrity revenge, like a tell-all. Yeah. No regular person's tell-all is going to sell. They don't care. It doesn't. Right. That doesn't matter. No, I tell people not to worry about writing at all. Like the quality of the writing, especially early, because that's not why you're writing the book. You're writing the book to tell your story. And a lot of times we tell people is to rewrite your story. Not to change it, because you can't change what happened, of course. But you get to decide what your story means, right? The facts are always going to be the same. But you get to decide, my mother abandoned me. That when I was 15, that it meant X to me. When I was 20, it meant Y to me. Now that I'm 40, it means Z to me. You get to decide what it means. And a memoir is the best way to do that.
Yeah.
I have to say, Airbnb has changed my life. I just love staying in Airbnbs. Like, in about a month, I'm going to Cocoa Beach, which is right next to Cape Canaveral. I'm going to watch some rocket launches. I'm going to, of course, be staying in a very nice Airbnb on the beach. And it's just such a great experience. Like, the whole world is available to us now because of Airbnb. But whenever I'm at an Airbnb, I always realize, you know, the home that I left to come to this Airbnb, I could be making money on that right now by hosting and being an Airbnb myself. So, and I've known people, I had a friend who basically, you know, made a living from turning his home into an Airbnb. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, you do have an Airbnb there. And it can easily fit into your lifestyle, and it's a great way to earn some money. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours. And they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now you could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop. Really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.
So what challenges have you, when you've been dealing with authors, is there pushback? Like, yeah, you kind of have to get them to dig a little deep.
No, we don't push people that way because people can only go so far. And so we'll tell people, Like you may end up writing I've written what, 4 memoirs. I'm working on my next one right now.
Really?
Like all about psychedelic therapy and all that, and all the stuff I realized in that and how it changed. Oh yeah, dude, I'm doing all that. Like my story of that. Yeah, you know, like I wrote that piece on Medium about it. That was just my first 2 things. I'm 2 years in now.
Well, also these lessons you've learned, it's a companion piece because what you've learned from this therapy is it's coming out of you in these lessons you've learned.
Here, I want your opinion on this. Here's what I think I'm going to start doing is I'm going to keep tweeting them exactly the way they are. Short, pithy, to the point. But then I think I'm going to get on like my little rig here and record sort of like, you know, what did I used to do? What did that cause? What lesson did I learn? Which then would be the tweet. And then what do I do now? You know, and it wouldn't be long. Probably anywhere from 2 to 10 minutes max about each one of these, kind of giving a little bit of a backstory and a little bit of examples, and do that as like YouTube videos and podcasts. What do you think about that idea?
I love it because that's where you introduce the story into the lesson.
There you go. Exactly.
When you give the lesson, look, you're a good writer. So you give the lesson, so it forces me to think of my story and how this applies, right? Because you're not giving anything other than a mirror in the lesson.
Right.
But when you throw in your story, that's when I really want to see how it applies. And then I'll really even more deeply relate.
Go even deeper.
Yeah. So in whatever format, it doesn't matter the format, whether you write it, video, podcast, do all 3.
I think I will. I think I'm going to add that on. I'm not going to change what I'm doing. I'm just going to add that.
No, yeah, don't change what you're doing because there's a lot of value in just the short. You know, again, I look back to my posts, you know, from 10 years ago. They're long. Yeah. Maybe I should have done some of them as more short, pithy.
You know why I started doing short, man, is to learn copywriting. Like being a great book writer and being a great copywriter are totally different
right.
things.
100% different.
And it was a forcing function for me to really start to be precise with my words. That's why I put it on Twitter first and I get it short and then I put it on the other ones.
That's why this is like 10 years ago. That's why I would do Facebook first and then, you know, later on have a book or whatever. But now your Twitter, you're right. You're limiting it to 280 characters. There's a lot of different models of what makes a good copywritten, you know, message, but it sort of feels like you're doing what's called the PAS model, problem, agitate, solution. So, you know, I used to, you know, think like this, caused much suffering, and here's a solution.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's a lot of times I do that. That is pretty standard. Yeah. The thing I'm really trying to do is get the idea across in the most compressed, condensed way possible.
Yeah, I took some of my favorites and I've been copy pasting them because a lot of times I'll read them and I'll say, yeah, that's exactly what happened to me, even though might not have been talking about anything remotely similar to that. So like here, if I want to control, here's one you wrote. If I want to control a situation, my best strategy is to ask more questions rather than try to tell people what to do or give answers. There is far more control in questions than there ever is in directives. And that's
frame.
A real powerful, you know, you were referring to frame control earlier. It's a very powerful frame as well.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly. So I'm talking about frame control there.
Yeah. So like, you know, this is very important in parenting, for instance. If you tell a kid, look, you're not going out tonight. Of course they're going out tonight, whether you like it or not.
Right.
But if your thing is to say like, well, what do you think about, I don't know, what do you think about all these killings happening right outside the door? I don't know. If you just ask questions and get them to think. Like I used to try to argue with my oldest daughter about college. And right. I would say to her, like, you can't go to college because this. She would literally just turn around and walk away from me.
Yeah.
Like, no response, nothing. And I would say, you can't just walk away from me. She would just keep walking. There's no point in trying to control her. But if I start saying, like, why do you think Google is suddenly not asking for degrees anymore? Or why do you think, you know, you want to be an actress? Why do you think some people get great acting jobs between the ages of 18 and 22? Do you think they went to college? What happened there? And you're right. Asking the questions plants the seeds and gets them thinking.
Yep. Ericksonian therapy. It's the way he did it. He would just tell stories and ask questions. That's it. Never told anyone what to do ever.
So let's see. There's I love this one as well. Like everybody, I'm sure this has happened to you. If you ever end a relationship and then suddenly the other person is just constantly thinking you're toxic. No one could ever admit or acknowledge that they might have had something to contribute to this.
Of course.
You have this great lesson. You say, the only toxic relationship I can have is with myself. Every other relationship in my life is simply a reflection of the relationship I have with myself. Once I really got this, I had to make many changes. So I love the general net. I had to make many changes. There's no story there. There's just kind of this is like the umbrella on top of a story.
Mm-hmm. It is. And do you notice the way I frame them too? Every single one, I never say you. It's never second person. It's never telling anyone else what to do. It's always me. Always.
Yeah, that's interesting. Let's see. And here's another one similar. So a relationship that cannot tolerate... This is actually an extremely important one. I might even have commented on this when you first put it out there. A relationship that cannot tolerate a thoughtful conversation about needs, disappointments, and desires is not a healthy relationship. Okay. We could have just done the entire podcast and just said that one line.
Easily.
And then, hey, good to see you. Good talking to you. That's such an important concept.
Mm-hmm. Tell me
a story there. Give me an example.
I mean, God, I could just talk about a million things in my marriage alone. Like both Veronica and I both, when we met and still even years later, are not very good at expressing things in our needs. So like, for example, I can't stand it when she uses my razor to shave her legs, right? And she stopped doing it. But for a while, this was like a big fight in our house. And so I would like criticize her and yell at her and like get so upset about this, right? And I was expressing I had a need. And the need was I needed my razor to be reserved for my face, right? And I was expressing this criticism of her. Why would you do this? You don't care about me. You're so selfish. Right? And then eventually I'm like, I realized, okay, she's not getting this. So I had to start talking about it. Like, when you use my razor, I feel like you don't care about me. Because I've asked you about this multiple times and then you do it anyway. And it makes me feel like, why are we even in a relationship? Like if the person I'm with can't even respect a simple boundary I'm trying to draw. And then she was fucking crying and like, because it wasn't about criticizing her. I expressed it as my need, not a problem with her.
Well, let me ask you this. What if you don't really know what your needs are? Because let's say you got to
think and figure those out then.
Yeah, because a lot of relationships, and this is talking about frame control, a lot of relationships, as you know, there's something called frame fatigue, where one person has too much of the frame all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, so the other person just disintegrates in frame. And
that's called codependency.
So just define that, because I always hear that.
It's essentially when you are relying on the other person to feel emotions for you. Right. Mm-hmm. And so in a relationship like that, if someone controls the frame the whole time and the other person doesn't, the person controlling the frame the whole time is getting something from them. Right. They need whatever it is, a submissiveness from a partner, they need the illusion of control, they need something. There's a reason, because if someone is powerful enough to control their frame all the time and is a higher level of consciousness, they're going to be with someone who can hold the frame back on them, who can have their own frame, right? And because when you're in a relationship, they have their frames, you have your frames, and then there are co-frames. You know, like our relationship is defined. It's a negotiated thing, relationships are, right? And so it's not all one thing. And so like in any relationship, it is negotiated and both the needs are being met. It's so like that woman is getting, I'm assuming it's a man controlling the frame, but it doesn't have to be. It's not by any stretch. But the man's getting something he wants. And so is the woman. It's not, he's not the bad guy there. They're both equally bad or good. There's really not a moralistic judgment. They're both trying to meet their own needs, really not through effective ways in terms of if they want to like have a happy, elevated consciousness and a good life, but it works It makes him less anxious about control. It makes her feel a sense of security. Let's say, I'm just guessing, right? Okay, then it's sort of like, why is a drug addict a drug addict? Why is a heroin addict a heroin addict, which is a great example? Because the heroin works. The heroin is a way for them to manage the pain of unfelt emotions, right? It may destroy the rest of their life, but it works. It absolutely does what it's supposed to do, right? And so like, it's that idea.
So this next one I think is really great. There's a lot in here, which is, so I'm quoting you now, "The most important decision in my life is who I spend my time with. The most important actions I take are what I do to make sure I create value for them." And you're talking about, you say, my work, both personal and professional. And then everything else is noise. And I think that the first line is absolutely, you know,
it's the thing.
Yeah, it's also like you're the average of the five people you spend your time with, and yep. And so. But this idea that the most important actions I take are what I do to make sure I create value for them, that's incredibly important for people to understand, because there's so many instances where you're trying to reflect your own importance in a relationship as opposed to thinking about the self-worth and needs of the other person, and that could be in a conversation at a networking cocktail party, or it could be in work, or it could be in relationships, like,
or with your kids. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. People don't want you to establish dominance over them. They want to know you think they're important, and you have to provide value for them to realize that, for them to give you want to give them status in those situations. And yeah, I think that's a really valuable lesson. So, look, Tucker, it's always great to update. And how's business? You run a publishing company.
We're doing good, man. March was a disaster, like it was for almost everybody. We had a full slate of sales calls, and then 2 days later, we had zero. Zero. And then we launched Scribe Book School in March, and it blew up. And we taught 10,000 people how to write their book for free, either nonfiction or memoir. And now that's kind of blown up. It launched a whole lower tier coaching program that's been doing amazing. And then we're on track. We had our best month of all ever in our history in June.
That's
and
great.
Then our second best month was April, and our third best month was May.
So, wow, that's awesome.
Like, we've had a pretty good 3 months. Yeah.
And you know, originally you were doing a lot of I'll call it like business self-help, you know, marketing, business, sales, mm-hmm. management, leadership. Yep. And do you think that became, those books kind of became, there's too many of them now?
No, quite the opposite. We've only just started.
All right, good. Yeah, I mean, and by the way, this is some of those books I really enjoy, like Joey Coleman's one of my favorite people in the world.
I think we've only just started. I think we have literally just started. I think the day is going to come where it's basically an entry point into being a high-level professional that you have a book. If you don't, it used to be what a college degree was. It used to be like, if you don't have a college degree, it's like, how can you be taken seriously, right? And now no one cares anymore because everyone got them. It's not a marker of status anymore. And maybe unless you went to Harvard or something, but even then it's like, oh, look, another asshole is telling me he went to Harvard, right? I think a book for most knowledge workers is going to be the gateway into high level. Because if you can't, what it takes to write a book and the way it allows you to be judged, I think are 10 times better than a college degree. You can fake your way into a college degree, you can bullshit, like it's easy to bullshit a college degree. It's not easy to bullshit a book. Even if you pay a bunch of money and get a great ghostwriter, okay, let's say I'm a potential client. Like, let's say you're a CEO coach, you're $100,000 a year. I read your book and I know it. If you got a great ghostwriter, you don't actually know your things, I'm going to figure it out real quick if I read your book. It won't take long.
You know, and also I think I heard you say this in a talk a while ago that, let's say a conference or a corporation is trying to decide who to pick as a speaker or a consultant or whatever. Everybody's equally qualified, but one person has a book. That's the person who's going to get hired.
Always go with the person with the book. Always. That's easy. Yeah.
So there was that. And then there was another thing you told me, this related to the memoir stuff, or you didn't tell me this was in a presentation you gave, but write your memoir you know, now in a world of self-publishing, you know, anybody can write any book, and the, you know, sales are always unpredictable, no matter whether you have, you know, Simon & Schuster as your publisher or you self-publish, sales are random. But think about, this is the first time we can write a book now for our great, great, great grandchildren to get to know who we are.
That is the argument I make in our, the entry point of Scribe Book School is, should you write a book? And the story I tell is that my dad's grandmother, my great-grandmother, immigrated from Hungary in like 1915 and changed her name to Max at Ellis Island, along with my grandfather. They moved to LA and raised my grandfather and father as Catholics. I did a 23andMe 6 years ago. Turns out we're Jews. I'm Ashkenazi Jew, 25%. My dad's 50, my grandfather's 100%. She and my grandfather never told anyone, including their children.
That's hilarious.
I would pay any amount of money to have her story.
Yeah, that's a good point. And you'll never have it.
Nope. Not unless the afterlife is a thing. Then maybe I will.
Well, on that note, first, I don't even know. So everybody should check out Scribe Media, your publishing company. There's so many different services you do. There's not just one. I won't describe them all. Check it out.
If you want to write and publish a book, we're the place.
But any facet of that. Like yep. you'd basically handle any facet of that. Other than, I don't think you do marketing, but that's
Yeah,
not
we
your,
do. Actually, we marketing do? Is half of our business now. We just don't advertise it externally. We only work with clients because we have so many.
Oh, maybe I have to talk to you then. And but everybody should check it out. People should also check out your tweets and your Facebook page. Every place you put these lessons you've learned, they're great and they're life-changing and they're very thought-provoking. So
thank you, brother.
I really enjoy them, and I can't wait for the book of the stories, and I can't wait for the eventual book about the lessons, because it's going to be great. And once again, so great to have you on the podcast. I think you were like my first guest, and now you're my latest guest.
I know, do I still own the record for the most appearances? I've been on like 5 or 6 times. Maybe
yeah, I think even
times.
On more than that, because we've divided like several of them into two. Probably we'll
yeah,
divide
we usually
this into
do 2-hour episodes. So yeah. I probably have like 10 or 15 now.
Yeah. You know, you've been up there. And of course, there's people always like, it's, you know, this is a whole other story. So we'll get into it next time, more about the cancel culture. But once again, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, James.
Yeah, it was fun.
It was very fun.
With the Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card, you can earn unlimited 2% cash rewards on purchases you want and purchases you need. That means you earn 2% cash rewards on what you want, like season tickets to watch your favorite team, and 2% cash rewards on what you need, like paying for parking. That's the beauty of the Active Cash Credit Card. It's ready when you are, with unlimited 2% cash rewards. The Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card. That's real life ready. Terms apply. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/activecash.